right, folks. Fernando, James. We're going to go ahead and get started. We have a lot of material to cover today. Thank you for coming to this event on broadband competition. Is the glass half empty or half full? I'm Ken Faree from the Progress and Freedom Foundation, and I guess in some sense I'm your ultimate host for today's festivities. When I was thinking about this event, I kept thinking of something that I heard that somebody said sometime, somewhere. I have no idea who it was, so I can't give proper attribution. But the saying was, in the end, we're all captives of reality. And I'm hoping that's really what this event will be about today, is reality. So much of what I hear, at least in the realm of broadband policy, tends to be sort of fanciful and fantastic and based on philosophies and ideologies and beliefs. And today, at least for the next hour and a half, I would ask you to suspend belief, I guess, and delve into the world of reality with us. So your host for this little trip will be Barbara Espin, senior fellow at the Progress and Freedom Foundation and our director of our Center for Competition and Communications and Competition Policy. So with that, I will turn it over to Barbara.
And I, too, want to thank you all for coming today. And we're very pleased to see this turnout. It's such a beautiful day, and we're so far underground. I appreciate your coming down here and your ability to find this room. In keeping with the rejoinder cherished by economists, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. We have provided no free cookies with your lunch. I hope you don't mind. And now we'll turn to the substantive portion of our program. Former New York City Mayor Ed Koch was famous for asking his constituents, "So how am I doing?" The question, "How are we as a nation doing on broadband competition?" is an important one. It lies at the heart of many key policy debates today, including how best to dispense stimulus funding, how to structure our national broadband policy, and what regulatory framework best fits today's communications marketplace. I have invited this very distinguished group of economists here today to share with you the results of their recent studies on how America is doing on broadband competition. Before we begin, I just want to let you know that nextgenweb.org is videotaping this event and will post the video on their website. I'm going to give only very brief introductions so that we can move directly to the presentations. More extensive biographies of each panelist are included in the written materials. In the interest of efficiency, I note that each panelist holds a PhD in economics and that each has been affiliated with one or more Washington-based think tanks over the course of his career. With that, I'm very pleased to present Robert Atkinson. Rob is president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, a Washington, D.C.-based technology policy think tank. Dr. Atkinson is one of the most prolific authors of research reports on technology and innovation policy and host of informative and thought-provoking panel discussions in this town. As a member of the Friendly Competition, I am in awe of his energy and abilities. Next to him is Larry Darby. Larry is principal of Darby Associates and senior fellow at the American Consumer Institute. Dr. Darby has held a variety of academic, government, and industry positions in the telecommunications and finance fields, including service at the Federal Communications Commission as chief economist, chief of the Common Carrier Bureau, as well as senior economist in the White House Office of Telecommunications Policy. Dr. Darby currently teaches about regulation in telecommunications and financial markets as adjunct professor at the George Mason University Law School. Next to him is Jeffrey Eisenat. Jeff is chairman and managing partner at Empiris LLC, a Washington, D.C.-based economic consulting firm, and also adjunct professor at the George Mason University Law School. Dr. Eisenach's practice focuses on economic analysis of antitrust, regulatory, and consumer protection issues. He is the author of numerous research reports and expert testimony on regulatory law and policy. And among his other affiliations, he is also a past president of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. Next to Jeff is George Ford. George is chief economist and co-founder of the Phoenix Center. George is chief economist and co-founder of the Phoenix Center for Advanced Legal and Economic Policy Studies, also in Washington, D.C. Dr. Ford has served as a professional economist at the FCC and in the private sector for large and small telecommunications firms, and is also a prolific author of scholarly studies and expert testimony on the application of economics and econometrics to public policy issues. Last but not least, we have Thomas Hazlett. Tom is professor of law and economics at the George Mason University Law School. Dr. Hazlett is an internationally recognized expert on telecommunications policy. He is currently a columnist for the Financial Times New Technology Policy Forum and is widely published in economic journals, law reviews, and media outlets. Dr. Hazlett, too, is an FCC veteran, serving as chief economist from 1991 to 1992. Coincidentally, 1991 was my first year as an FCC attorney in the Common Carrier Bureau's Tariff Division. At the time I entered, the FCC was moving away from telephone carrier tariffs based on cost of service and rate of return principles and instituting a price cap system of rate review. When I arrived, I was informed by a Tariff Division veteran, in all earnestness, that price caps would put us out of work. And the Tariff Division is no more, having been renamed the Competitive Pricing Division. What I don't quite understand is the need to regulate competitive prices, but I think it does illustrate the endurance of regulatory institutions. Turning now to our panel, I've asked Dr. Eisenach to lead off the discussion with the results of his study on whether the U.S. approach to broadband policy, focusing on intermodal competition, is working in producing consumer benefits.
Barbara, thank you. Thank you all for being here today. I think this is an important topic, and as we move forward to get some top-level political appointees in place at the FCC and NTIA, it's about to get to be a very active topic. I started in this environment in 1994, 95, 96, in that period, and things were kind of moving in a different direction. But one thing that we had in common with what's going on today is people were asking very fundamental questions. And for those of you who have not had a chance to do so, I'll just kind of give you a very brief précis. If you did have the chance to do so, if you were to read the filings that went in yesterday or Monday in the broadband NOI to the Federal Communications Commission, if you were to read some of the books that have come out of places like Public Knowledge and Free Press and New America Foundation, what you would see there is a going back to basics, reexamination from the most fundamental level of every aspect of telecom policy for the past 15 years or so. I think it'd be hard for me to to say I find very much that I agree with in the conclusions coming out of those studies. I think they're about 180 degrees diametrically as wrong as they could be. But the substance of them in terms of the searching for a different set of answers and the asking of fundamental questions, I think, is very healthy. I mean, we're talking about going back and reexamining Computer 1, Computer 2, Computer 3, the wireline broadband order, really all of the things that got us to where we are today. And parts of the critique, I think, are valid to the extent that the law did not anticipate a broadband slash internet environment, and the FCC to some extent has made it up as it's gone along in an effort to craft a policy and a statutory framework which is still very much a silo-based framework. You know, that critique, as far as it goes, I think is a reasonably fair one. Again, I think the kinds of outcomes that people are advocating today are pretty misdirected, and with that, let me explain why. There are two. I think we're getting ready to perhaps make policy, I hope not, on the basis of two big, I'm going to be on my best behavior and say misconceptions, about the state of the world. The two misconceptions are this. First of all, that the U.S. is somehow behind relative to the rest of the world in terms of the deployment of broadband and where we are and where we're going in the broadband environment. And I just think that's 100% incorrect, and we can talk about that on a country-by-country basis, which is almost what you need to do, or a region-by-region basis. But I think that characterization is just fundamentally wrong, and the statistics upon which it's based are, you know, either meaningless or incorrect. So there's a and if you look at the debate, you know, maybe 60 or 70% of the rationale, maybe more, for why we need to dramatically turn things around and do something different is grounded in this one simple misconception that the U.S. is way behind the rest of the world. We should do something different. So I'll talk about that for a second. The second one, and I know others on the panel are going to talk about this also, in particular my co-professor at George Mason, Dr. Darby, so I wouldn't want to step on his remarks. But the second issue has to do with duopoly and the state of competition in the U.S., and the notion that we have something approaching a cozy duopoly in the broadband market. We only have two pipes. We're clearly only ever going to have two pipes, I think, is as misguided as the first premise. Now, you know, why is it I don't think we're behind in the world? This is one of those things where, you know, it almost seems like one of those cases where people believe the more, if you repeat it often enough, you know, it must be true. But first of all, 80% of that argument is grounded in one statistic. The U.S. is 15th in the world when it comes to broadband subscriptions per 100 inhabitants, according to the OECD study, which has been done over the course of several years. Others, people other than me, and Scott Walston has, in particular, I think, done a great job, have critiqued that study. And it's not that there's anything wrong with the study in and of itself. It's just you have to look at what it means and how the data is, like any other statistic, how the data is collected and what it means. When you look at that study in detail, you find that there are a number of big problems, one of which is that the OECD does not do a good job separating out business connections from residential connections. So it's pretty clear that in most other countries in which they're counting broadband connections, they're counting business connections. In the United States, they're not counting business connections. So the U.S. is biased down. They're also looking at comparing countries with smaller household sizes to the United States, which has a larger household size. And so when you do that on a per capita basis as opposed to a per household basis, again, you're biasing the statistics down. That's one issue with that. There are other, you know, statistics that get cited. One that I saw that my friend Drew Clark had an event up here on the Hill, I guess, the other day, and Jim Kohlenberger was up citing statistics from the International Telecommunications Union, the Digital Opportunity Index. This is what the report said anyway. If you look at, this is what Kohlenberger said, if you look at the ITU's Digital Opportunity Index, it lists the U.S. as 21st, right behind Estonia and tied with Slovenia. The president has looked at these rankings and called them unacceptable. That's why he's made broadband access for all a national priority. Now, if the president's looked at those rankings, which I doubt, I hope he has looked at the ones that show that the U.S. is not 21st, it's 13th, that Estonia and Slovenia are no place in the same neighborhood with the United States. And I hope he's also deconstructed them a little bit and found out that the index that we're looking at is counting things like the number of people with televisions and the number of people with landline telephone connections. So it has very little to do with broadband. You know, that people, I think, have now gotten to the point where the statistic is true enough that you can give any version of it out whether or not the facts match the statistic and expect to be believed. So I think that's I hope people be more careful with their statistics. But more broadly, if you look at what's going on in the U.S., what you see is innovation, and you see that competition is driving innovation. The U.S. is rapidly becoming the most fiber-prevalent country in the world. Probably won't catch up with Korea and Japan very soon, but those were done with essentially government build-outs, government-subsidized build-outs. If you look at the European Union, which is following the policies that most of the more liberal folks in the U.S. are advocating, you see a world where there is essentially no fiber build-out happening in the European Union, nor is there any fiber build-out likely to happen in the European Union anytime soon, except in Sweden, where municipalities, again, government entities, are actually building the fiber. Or where competitors are building the fiber, as in France. You don't have incumbent companies, as in the U.S., building fiber. The U.S. is leading in DOCSIS 3 deployment. with 50 and 100 megabit DOCSIS 3 capabilities being rolled out, and being rolled out essentially in the same places where the telephone companies have upgraded their networks. So you see a tremendous amount of innovation going on in the U.S. The price comparisons that you see, same deal. Do what I did this morning. Go on the Comcast, the Cox, the Verizon, and the Virgin Media websites. And price a double play internet service. And what you'll find is that Cox, Comcast, and Verizon are all very competitive with what you can buy in the United Kingdom, for example. Now, you can cherry pick different offerings. And in general, if you look at triple play, television is more expensive for a comparable offering in the U.S. than it is in other countries. But if you think about the market for television, there are a lot of things going on in the market for television that are very idiosyncratic per country. So, number one, I don't think you can make a general case that the U.S. is behind in the world. In fact, if you look at what's happening in the U.S. in terms of the speed of rollout and how quickly that has happened since broadband was deregulated in the U.S. just 5 years ago, I think what you see is that the U.S. is on a very healthy course. Now, on the duopoly point, and I'm about to go over time here, but on the duopoly point, I'll just say, because I know Larry is going to cover, you know, how duopolists behave, but I challenge the assumption at a much more fundamental level. There are not two pipes, right? There are at least four pipes covering 80% or more of Americans, the other two being 3G wireless networks from Verizon and AT&T. And if you look at some of the latest Nielsen reports, you will see that Nielsen is telling us that wireless data substitution has begun up the same path as wireless voice substitution was on 5 years ago. We're now at something like 25% of Americans do not have landline telephones. So we have begun up that path on the data side. There are at least three pipes, and new entry, hand over fist. T-Mobile is building out its 3G network, Verizon and AT&T about to build out 4G networks, and, of course, Clearwire, backed by Google and Intel, is building out its 4G network in 47 cities as we speak today. So I don't think we're last in the world. I don't think we're a duopoly. And I think when you take those two arguments away, the impetus for changing policy dramatically in the U.S. pretty much disappears.
Tom, would you like to pick up from there?
Sure. Thinking about a session I was at last summer where folks were going around the table talking about how far the U.S. was falling behind in the broadband race, and there was a U.K. regulator in the group, and he kind of sheepishly jumped into the conversation. And he said, "Well, I feel a bit of an outsider here. I'm quite delighted to know how far behind you're falling. In fact, in the U.K., we have the mirror discussion about how far we're falling behind. And, of course, the fact is we're all falling behind. Okay, this is an inverted Lake Wobegon situation. And I think National Science Foundation funds should be put to finding out how the entire world can fall behind. And, in fact, the Koreans are falling behind. I don't know if you've seen their precipitous drop. In percentage terms, far worse than the United States. They used to be number one. I think they're, what, number eight now? So the decline is on, and we're all sinking into the abyss. Anyway, my name is Tom, and I'm a PowerPoint user. And I had not understood the scope and reach of the current efforts to clean up Washington. When I came down here to Capitol Hill today, and I did not know that this was a PowerPoint-free zone. I commend your efforts. I should have gone to some rehab. I think this cold turkey stuff is challenging, but I just want to say I have some probably the best PowerPoint slides that have ever been produced. I'm sure you'd be astonished at the quality and clarity of these slides if you were able to see them. But I will do my best to describe them. In talking about this is just a personal quirk of mine, I always start off by attacking the title of the session that I've been asked to comment on. And so, keeping with form, I'll say that the burden of proof here is just upside down, and that is to say, looking at the market half full or half empty, who knows? The fact is, competition is not the prime policy issue. The policy issue is: are there rules out there? Are there reforms out there that will actually improve efficiency? Have we not done something we could do that's going to produce some costs and benefits that pencil out to an improvement for the American people. Now, it's simply a fact that more competition would be nice, more competition between the existing incumbents, more capacity, more innovation between them, more entry. All else equal, competition improves things. I will drop a small note into here. When I hear people seriously addressing the spectrum artificial scarcity problem and do it in terms of what we are doing, which is to waste the best spectrum on Earth with the TV banned white spaces campaign to eliminate any possibility of moving the TV broadcasters ever out of there through market settlements and negotiated deals to move this 1952 killer application out of the best 294 megahertz we have, the most valuable 294 megahertz in the world, then I'll know that people are getting serious about this thing in terms of actual competition. But when we address broadband policies per se, we really want to be sure that we're focusing on exactly the right issue, the right policy margin. Can we do something here that's going to create more output and lower cost for Americans? So, turning to my next slide, the broadband duopoly thesis does have a testable implication. Okay, the idea that we have ipso facto a broadband duopoly that is a problem and needs to be regulated. That's usually about the amount of time spent fleshing out the subtle issues in the analysis. It's very rarely said, by the way, that if we had this discussion 100 years ago and we talked about the duopoly in railroads or the duopoly in telephony, and there was a duopoly in a lot of markets in telephony, the issue would be, is dog-eat-dog competition going to be ruinous and eliminate all the investments that have been made? That would be the thrust of that conversation. So see how quickly things change just in 100 years. We're looking at things from just the opposite way. Now it's ipso facto. If you can actually pronounce the word duopoly, you're able to move on to the presumption that regulation of that duopoly market should be undertaken. But one thing I'd like to hang around for and look at in the broadband duopoly, and I'm quite willing to look at it as a duopoly if that's the way people want to talk about it, cable modem versus DSL/Fios. There is a very nice testable implication there, and that is, are there excess profits being earned in that market or submarket, that part of the telecommunications world? Is that a lucrative business for those cable modem and DSL suppliers? So that's one thing we can't actually take a minute to look at. And then the second thing is to turn to the proper policy margin and ask the question, will open access rules, the rules that are being advocated as a remedy to the so-called broadband duopoly, do those rules actually result in a higher output? And fortunately, we do have, in this country, we've conducted laboratory experiments in the marketplace under real-world conditions that allow us to make some judgment about whether or not the open access rules will actually improve investment, improve consumer choice, and in fact result in consumers getting more service in the broadband space. So the recent report put out by Bernstein & Company, June 4th, takes a very close look at the telephone side of the broadband duopoly. And if you want to look at the all Verizon shareholders, cover their ears for this, by the way. Verizon Wireline, the entire wireline business for Verizon now generates earnings before interest, taxes, and depreciation of about $12 billion. Unfortunately, nearly $10 billion of that is spent in capital spending. That was for 2008. The actual numbers that are projected just through 2013 end up yielding losses in 2012 and 2013. Earnings minus CapEx is a negative number. So that's out into the future. Usually you like to get positive numbers when you're investing, and you like to run it out to some terminal value that can be capitalized at, you know, 8 times, 12 times, whatever your accounts will let you get away with, to show how well you're doing. These numbers are going in the wrong direction. Now, this is the entire wireline side of Verizon, the entire wireline business. If you actually take the present values on the numbers that Bernstein, a third party, independent third parties put together, you get values of under $700 per subscriber for all wireline subscribers. Now, wireline, the sunk value of the investments made, the sunk costs of the investments made in those systems are well north of $2,000. The current Fios systems being built are well north of $3,000 per wireline subscriber. And there's nothing to show for that, according to the third-party estimates right now. We hope for Verizon shareholders, of course, that this gets better. But the fact is, looking at this submarket, it's hard to see where the duopoly profits are, okay? A lot of other evidence that goes with that, but that's just one dramatic way of putting it. Now, turning to broadband policy, there is a paper that has some pretty pictures in it, December 2008, Review of Network Economics, Anil Kaliskan, recent PhD at George Mason University. She and I wrote a paper called Natural Experiments in U.S. Broadband Regulation. Well, we take the experiments, the natural experiments that have been done in this country, where we've had different regimes for DSL versus cable modems. Cable modem service, of course, has never been regulated with open access rules. DSL was fairly heavily regulated until the beginning of 2003, when the line sharing, so-called line sharing rules were eliminated, and then there was a further deregulation in 2005. Now, the prediction was made when the deregulation of DSL took place in early 2003, that was the primary dereg, that prices would go up because network sharing rules were being taken away, effectively being eliminated. And in fact, what happens very clearly in the data that when you adjust for the contemporaneous subscriber growth in cable modems to adjust for DSL trends and also use the Canadian data where we didn't have the same deregulation or regulation going on. It all works out the same with all the controls. The fact is that DSL growth takes off with deregulation in 2003, and just by the end of 2006, we actually get an additional 10 million. That's 60% more. This is from a projected 15 million household base at the end of 2006, projected by the trend pre-deregulation. We're actually up at 25 million households, approximately, by the end of 2006. So there's a delta there of 10 million households. Growth takes off. So the bottom line on this is, and as I say, the article's out there for details, and I'm out of time. I'm sorry that the slides were not available to you. Just spectacular graphics. But the message is that the regulation should pass the cost-benefit test. When we intervene in the market, things should get better for consumers. And we have actually run some experiments here. They're fairly important. And we ought to take a good hard look at how, in fact, consumers in their choices as subscribers to one or one system or another or none at all decided to become subscribers of cable broadband or DSL providers. And we'll see that there's actually a very positive correlation between subscribership and deregulation and a negative correlation the other way around. Open access rules have actually discouraged and deterred the expansion of broadband networks. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Larry, would you?
Thank you, Barbara. I'm happy to be here and listen to my learned colleagues. A lot of that I agree with, and so I'm going to sort of truncate my remarks rather than repeating them. When we started discussing this, Barbara asked me, to summarize some research I'd been doing on duopoly, on market structure, relationship between market structure, market conduct, market performance, and how what kinds of tests we ought to require for if we're going to do, as Tom suggested, somewhat would like us to do, return to an earlier era of regulation. Senator Dan Moynihan observed that folks are entitled to their own opinions, but not to their own facts. So it is in the debate over public and private roles in a national broadband policy. In the next few minutes, I want to add some facts to some widely expressed opinions on one issue in that debate, that is the importance of duopoly market structure per se in the provision of broadband services. Jeff is absolutely right that it's not a broadband, it's not precisely a duopoly, that most users have 3, 4, 5, 6 more, depending on how you define the relevant market. But I want to go to the core of the argument and examine sort of the case for duopoly. And again, much of this argument is being taken place in the realm of rhetoric. I mean, duopoly has about as much meaning as open networks, which has somewhat less meaning than net neutrality, which, in my opinion, has almost no meaning whatsoever. But that's rather another topic that perhaps we can talk about. First, let me start with some opinions. One, the FCC has allowed a cozy duopoly of telephone and cable companies to dominate the broadband access market. The reliance on this cozy duopoly has been disastrous for the U.S. Consumers pay too much for too little. Now, that's an empirically verifiable proposition, so we ought to take a look at it instead of just continuing to say it. Two, opinion number two. Prices are well above cost plus reasonable profit. Investment is withheld until absolutely needed. Innovation is actively discouraged, and consumer welfare suffers. Now, I don't know what they're describing, but this is purportedly describes, you know, the state of the broadband market. Three, when a market has fewer than the equivalent of 6 equal-sized competitors, the market just doesn't function properly. Well, the implication of that statement alone is that the entire U.S. economy, or 99% of it outside the production of wheat and oats and soybeans, is unworkable. It's nonsense. Moreover, the FCC has ignored mountains, let me emphasize in case you didn't get that, mountains of evidence that our broadband markets are concentrated anti-competitive, and fundamentally broken. I didn't make that up. I took that out of some of the comments that were taken this last Monday. So much for the opinions. No matter how you interpret that, never mind what it says, never mind what kinds of market conduct we observe, or performance we can measure, the problem is the structure, duopoly. Not just duopoly, but cozy duopoly. Now, I looked up cozy, okay, to make sure. I didn't mischaracterize this characterization. My thesaurus suggests warmth and ease, commitment and comfort, family-like intimacy, close association, discreet and cautious attitudes. Now, I don't know how managers of telephone companies and cable act in private, but I can tell you publicly they belie those kinds of assertions. So these are opinions, and we're obliged to ask, where's the beef? Where are the facts? Let me give a few. No reasonable, well-objective, informed adverser would suggest any form of collusion between cable and telco broadband providers. Every indication that I can see is that they are aggressive rivals. I could go on and on and on, but my colleagues have documented these results substantially. No innovation in the sector? Where have these folks been? Take a look at what's happened to switching. Take a look at the whole digitalization, the movement from analog to digital. Take a look at the movement from wireline to fiber, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Or that firms are rationing capacity. Somebody just mentioned the Bernstein study. Actually, they're not rationing capacity, according to Bernstein. They're building too much capacity that won't return a fair investment to investors or fair return. Or to discriminate ways to create market power, no evidence of that. Or that there is excessive profit in the sector. And I'll return to that for a moment. The economic case for common carrier regulation sometimes refers to two events of market conduct. The Madison River service denial, which was taken care of many years ago, and the Comcast traffic management, or international differences. The proponent's case, regulation ultimately turns on market structure, duopoly. In fact, the principal corporate force behind the call for common carrier regulation explicitly stated as much in its comments to the FCC. And I quote, "The broadband problem is the market itself, rather than in a roster of actual or potential bad acts." In other words, the flaw is structural, not behavioral. With that in mind with you, I want to quickly review with you from 6 different perspectives some facts about duopoly. And this sort of gets to the essence of the paper we started writing some time ago. These views, can you find support for these propositions In the neoclassical industrial organization literature? No. Views from game theory? No. Outcomes from experimental economics? No. Evidence from other sectors served by two dominant firms? No. What competition policymakers throughout the world, United States and elsewhere, say? No. Or even evidence from the sector, the broadband sector itself. These contrast sharply with the views expressed in law journals by net neutrality advocates. I have a variety of quotes, and I'll read a couple of them. A fair assessment of scholarly work on the topic suggests no support for equating duopoly with market failure. Economists have developed literally dozens of oligopoly pricing theories, some simple, some marvels of mathematical complexity. Proliferation of theories is mirrored by an equally rich array of behavioral patterns actually observed. Casual observation suggests anything is possible. Indeed, the only conclusion from oligopoly theory is that there is no conclusion. It doesn't tell you. There's no policy relevance in it. Similarly with game theory. Recent survey. Having warned the reader at the outset there are many theories of oligopoly, I'm left with the task of identifying the lessons. What we are in need of most now, after reviewing some 200 different theories of duopoly, what we're needed of most now is are some empirical tests of their validity. No matter how you read that, it says there's nothing in the theory and none of it's been tested empirically. Now, these are professional economists that some of them, in fact, are even Nobel Prize winners. George Stigler wrote, and this is not new news, George Stigler wrote over 40 years ago, no one has the right, few the ability, to lure economists in reading another article on oligopoly theory without some advanced indication of its alleged contribution. Most of it is meaningless, he said. Well, so it is with most of the theory about duopoly. We looked at experimental economics. There are 150 published papers, by my count, on experimental economics looking at, in a laboratory sense, the impact of duopoly. These, by my count, are over 500 different constructions of the parameters that go into those decisions. The issues here today, the results can be summarized. Duopoly behavior is highly circumstantial. Conduct and performance vary along a continuum bounded by perfect competition and perfect monopoly. Most of the experiment had indeterminate outcomes. Most of the results were weak and not significant statistically, and a surprising number, and this is one I like, were inconsistent with received theory and our economic intuition. Well, I could go on. Let me talk to you a little bit about duopoly in other sectors. And one of my colleagues mentioned that. We've taken a look at 15 other duopoly sectors where the duopoly is defined by market share of the top two firms of 75% or more. And let me suggest to you the following, that there is no indication that there are remediable harms that can be addressed by common carrier type, rate and service, or any kind of intervention in markets involving Moody's and Standard & Poor, FedEx and UPS, Pepsi and Coke, Macy's and Gimbel's, Home Depot and Lowe's, Kodak and Fujifilm, MCI and AT&T in the early days, LexisNexis and Westlaw, and I could go on and on and on, and there are about a dozen others. No evidence there. Are these markets perfect? Are they without flaws? Are they replicas of the broadband duopoly? Of course not. But a fair assessment of the usual indices of market conduct from these sectors, conduct toward rivals, conduct toward consumers, and performance, profits, progress, innovation, there is no support for the proposition that duopoly requires any government intervention. Well, I'm beating a dead horse here, I think, and I'm going to run out of time, so I'm going to skip the views of competition policymakers worldwide. And I want to go to some of the evidence that I found in the broadband sector. I think, did you all get a handout that's got one sheet, one page on it? Well, let me just talk about that very, very quickly. What I did is I looked at five or six different entities, S&P 500, and the four major duopolists that are providing broadband services, AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, Time Warner Cable. And then I looked at another, just a randomly chosen advocate from the sector, Google. We put Google at the end. And so we're going to compare some of those. Excessive profits. The margins of broadband suppliers are in line with the S&P 500 for 2008 and the average for the past 5 years. What that data don't tell you is that the money, the profits are not coming from broadband. And again, close your ears if you're a Verizon shareholder. There are serious questions about the long-term payoff to the investment in broadband. Excessive returns to shareholders, returns on investment capital for broadband suppliers are well below the S&P average for 2008 and on average for the last 5 years. For example, AT&T and Verizon around 5.4, 4.5 on total investment capital. Time Warner Cable is losing money on minus 16.4 return on capital. This compares with S&P 500 of 11.1 and Google with 19.7. I'm curious about what they do with the cash. If I take a look at the S&P or if I take a look at the ratio of capital expenditures to operating cash flow, Jeff and I did a paper many years ago. It's a very interesting question. Where do the folks who get the money do it? Okay, 58, Verizon reinvests 65% of net operating cash flow. AT&T 58%, Comcast 62%, Time Warner 66%. So over 65% of the money generated by operations in these countries is companies going back to capital expenditures. That is well above the S&P average, and it's substantially above what I put in here for another well-known shareholder stakeholder in this area, 41%. Google puts 41% back. Well, there's more, but you get the idea. I have data on jobs. If you're really interested in creating jobs, you know, good jobs, high-paying jobs, you would look at this sector. So let me conclude. What are the implications of all this? First, our message to believers and advocates of the view that duopoly is a problem is drawn from Casey Stengel. Look it up. The answer is there. It's there. All you have to do is look it up. There is no evidence to support the structuralist view of the need for common carrier regulation. None, zero, not a zip. The evidence we find suggests the Scotch verdict, case not proven. Markets are imperfect, but so too are government regulatory programs. Again, as Casey would say, you can look it up. In our paper, we emphasize the differences in type 1 and type 2 errors, at the cost of regulating too much or regulating too little. We think the cost, the major costs are in regulating too much and not regulating too little. Our work has implications for ex post versus ex ante regulation. In English, the difference between passing rules to ensure that nothing bad happens versus waiting to address market failures when they actually happen. We found nothing of consequence to support a case for common carrier regulation based on market structure, nor on international comparisons, nor on two or three instances of market conduct. Common sense suggests it must be based on a thorough consumer welfare-oriented cost-benefit analysis of the actual conduct and the performance of the firms in these sectors. And, of course, as someone earlier mentioned, the well-known infirmities of government efforts to manage competitive processes. The Lord knows we had plenty of experimental evidence of that after the 1996 Act was passed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Larry. Rob?
Well, Larry, I think you did a grave disservice to the debate by introducing so much fact and data. But I'll try to remedy that by
offset that.
Talking generalities. I'm going to base my comments on an article I wrote for the Journal of Law and High Technology, which is out there on broadband competition. As much as I respect and agree with Jeff Eisenach on many, many things, I have to say on this one, I'm getting back at you for that event 8 years ago, Jeff. You remember what I'm talking about.
For 8 years.
So I have a long memory. I actually think we are behind. And I think it is a duopoly. But the reason we're behind, it really has nothing to do with market structure. The reason we're behind, and by the way, the household is the right number. If you use households, we're 12th, not 15th. The reason we're behind are two central facts. One is we have the longest loop length of any OECD country we could find data on, and that just makes it a lot more expensive. You have very short loop lengths in the leading countries, and it makes it a lot cheaper to do this. Secondly, we have some of the lowest computer penetration rates. Not a lot Verizon can do about that or Comcast. When you don't have computers, I don't think there's a lot of reason to subscribe to broadband. When you put those two factors together, I think it explains much of why we are at 12th and not number one. Secondly, I think we have a duopoly. I don't think it's cozy by any stretch of the imagination, nor is it stable. So I would have to say I fundamentally disagree with the people who filed comments to say that the flaw is structural. We really don't have flaw. The problem that we have, and we do have some problems, is not structural. It is much more about the kinds of policies or, frankly, lack thereof that we have not had in this country to promote broadband. I think maybe it was Jeff alluded to Japan and Korea. You want to know why they're so good? because they have policies that promote it. They gave tax incentives to companies to deploy high-speed networks. They have the best demand-side programs in the world to help low-income people buy computers and reuse them and learn them. And that's why they're number one. So we need to really be thinking about that. So having said all that, and I sort of make my comment to Tom, who I also have great respect for and all that, but Tom said competition, everybody knows competition improves things, and that does seem to be the consensus. Larry's cited, I think probably CFA said that six competitors is better than two. I actually think this is a case where six competitors would be much worse than two, and I want to talk about why I think that. I think the Washington consensus that they say basically says more competitors in this space is better is just fundamentally wrong. The reason I think it's fundamentally wrong is because these are incredibly expensive fixed cost capital investments that have to amortize themselves over a certain number of customers. So if you add, for example, Verizon, I love Verizon because they've given me fiber to the home, so I think it's great. But let's just say that they introduce three more competitors in every Verizon territory. That means that Verizon's ability to make any return is totally gone. The only way Verizon can make any return on that is if they have a reasonable number of competitors. How many of you, show of hands, have multiple water pipes coming to your house? Anybody multiple sewer pipes?
Yeah.
Multiple gas pipes?
Yeah, we own them.
Electric wires?
Okay.
That's my point. Nobody in this debate says, you know what, we need to have a second electric line to the home. And the reason we don't is because everybody recognizes, or they should recognize, it would be incredibly inefficient. It would be a giant waste of societal resources to go and build a second electric distribution system in this country. The reason we are actually in better shape than most countries is because by sort of, in some ways, luck and also in some ways smart regulation, we had two pipes going into the home that were able to transform themselves into broadband pipes. So we had a cable TV pipe and we had a telephone pipe. If you look at other countries, they didn't have that. A lot of them didn't have cable TV, or if they had cable TV, they made the unbelievably bad decision to let it be owned by the telephone company, which is what Germany did. And lo and behold, there was no cable modem deployment, because why would the telephone company deploy a competitive service against itself? So we are lucky in the sense that we happen to have two pipes, and as Larry said, it provides a lot of competition. And I think that has implications for how we think about competition, and in particular about this whole notion of underserved areas and what we should do about it. So if you look at some of the debate on what we should do with the stimulus money, or even in the National Broadband Plan, there are people who strongly advocate overbuilding, in particular municipal overbuilding. I think municipal overbuilding is a huge waste of money. It's a diversion of societal resources that should go to other places. And yet, there's this view that somehow if we subsidize this third pipe to the home and ideally have it be owned by a worker collective or by the city government, that we will get good results. I think what overbuilding is, it's the same thing in an inverse way of broadband taxation. It's a way for a local community to possibly benefit, but the costs are borne by other users. So let's just say hypothetically that there's a community that overbuilds where Verizon is deploying Fios. What they essentially do is they lower the rate of return, they lower the revenues that Verizon gets, and therefore every other customer has to pay more money. There is no free lunch here in the sense that if Verizon's built out an amateurized fixed cost network where a large share of their costs are fixed costs, if they have fewer customers, they only have one choice, and that's to raise rates. And so if you take communities that start to say, we're going to go after Verizon or whoever it is, AT&T or Comcast, go after the incumbent built-up network, essentially what they're doing is cherry-picking and everybody else is going to lose. Larry had much better data than I did, but I did a back-of-the-envelope calculation once, and if you take all of Verizon's profits, including their wireless business, their wireline, telephony, and broadband, and you say, you know what, if we had competition, we'd slash that by half. Let's just say we slash their profits by half. The price of their Their broadband fiber service goes down $1 a month from, this was a year ago, from $40 to $39 a month. So it clearly isn't competition or lack thereof that is driving where we are today. So where do we need to go with that? By the way, having said all that, I don't necessarily say that competition is a bad thing. There are certainly benefits that competition brings. It brings discipline to providers. It forces them to be innovative, and it forces them to try to cut costs and gain efficiencies. But in this case, I think we're in an optimal situation, actually. We have, in some ways, the optimal position in this whole SIT structure, which is we have more than one provider where there'd be no competition and you'd be forced to do the European model, which doesn't get you investment, so we have that. But we don't have too many providers, which means we essentially have efficient scale. And we have intense competition between the two providers. So what do we need to do? I would argue that the right policy with regard to competition is enable but don't promote. If the market produces more competition, sure, okay, that's all right, and maybe even good. But there are people in this debate, I've actually had debates with people on this, where I've proposed, for example, tax incentives for deploying fast broadband, like accelerated depreciation or tax credits. And I've had advocates say, yeah, that's a great idea, but we'll only limit it to new entrants. And that, to me, would be a bad idea because it would, A, distort the marketplace, and, B, it would, again, sort of artificially encourage overbuilding, which I think is a terrible waste of societal resources. So, for example, Seattle, I don't know if anybody's following this, at least they were a few months ago when I wrote an article on this, they're considering building a fiber-to-the-home network in Seattle, even though they have pretty good DSL and pretty good cable, which is going to get better. The second piece of this is that there certainly is technological innovation, and I wish I could sort of just, you know, stop the clock and say we're going to take a timeout on this debate until 2011 and then revisit the debate, because I think the debate will look quite different in 2011 when you have pretty robust LTE out there. And I think LTE, I'm, again, a little more skeptical with Jeff. I really don't think 3G is a substitute for most people. It has a modest competitive impact, but I don't think it really is a substitute. I would never give up my fiber for my 3G network. But I do think LTE does provide that with, you know, much, much higher speeds, 50, 60 megs possibly. The other piece of this that's happening is the next generation satellite technology. Am I at 1 minute? Right. Next generation satellite, everybody sort of poo-poos satellite, including me. But next generation satellite technology, which is coming on out around end of 2010, 2011, will get actually 3 megs, pretty good service at pretty reasonable costs, $45-$50 a month, which certainly can be a competition, particularly in rural areas. Last point, two more points I'll make. One is there are a lot of people who say, well, okay, maybe we have intermodal competition in Bethesda, but we don't have it out in so-and-so where you've only got Verizon or you've only got Comcast, and therefore we have to spend government money to build that second pipe. I think that's a fundamental misreading of how competition works and pricing works. If you go out and look at what the prices are on Verizon or Comcast or any of these providers and look and see if they have a different price, if they price differentiate by whether there's a competitor for that home, the answer is they don't. So they charge the same price for a home, you know, way out 50 miles from here where there's no competitor, and as they do in Bethesda, Maryland. Now, if for some reason they started to price differentiate, that to me would be a reason for the FCC to be involved and to say, wait a minute, we don't think you ought to do that. But as long as they don't price differentiate and they have regional pricing plans, then you have effective competition everywhere, even if you only have one provider. So you don't have to have a government policy to build even a second pipe. Last thing, I'll mention Japan, because everybody talks about Japan as the sort of model. They were able to combine competition and high speeds. What Japan did was they, besides the fact that they own NTT, which always helps if you want to be able to force investment and not worry about market rates of return. So I'm actually advocating that. I think that is my policy. Nationalize all. No. get a rise out of Jeff. So they did own NTT, 40% of it. But what they essentially did is they said, okay, well, you've got to unbundle your DSL, you've got to unbundle your copper. And so they got a lot of competition, Yahoo, Japan, all these other. But then they said, you know what, that's not good enough. We really want to get fiber to the home. So what did they do? They basically said to NTT, you can build fiber to the home, but you don't have to unbundle it. So technically, they have to unbundle it. In reality, they don't. The way this, if you unbundle, if you're a competitor, you essentially cannot get access to the NTT fiber. And the reason, and now the result is they have 80% fiber penetration. The Japanese aren't satisfied with that. They just came out with a stimulus plan 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago. They want to get 90% fiber. They're investing a large amount of money to subsidize that. So that's really, I would argue, the path we need to go down. I would argue there's three big models. There's the abdicate model, just do nothing. The regulate model, which is let's unbundle or let's do muni fiber. And I would argue the right model is the facilitate model, which is really what the Japanese, the Koreans, to some extent the Swedes have done. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Rob and George. Last but not least.
Well, I'll proceed like Rob and question some of my earlier commenters. Tom Hazlett, for example, has been very selective in his choice of experiments and has failed to discuss the open video service options from the past, which were wildly successful and amazingly similar to what is being proposed today. I was at the FCC at the time. Working with others. I was actually on detail of the Common Carrier Bureau, and we would have weekly meetings with the ILECs to tell them how wrong their financial plans were and how they needed to readjust them to make the numbers better so that we could allow them to make such investments in their open video systems. And that was a wildly successful government intervention. And as for normalizing broadband connections, I just released a paper last week. Households is better than populations, but fixed line telephones from 1996 is the best normalizing variable of all of the three options. I'm going to be a little more general even than Rob has been. The debate, I mean, when you talk about broadband competition, it seems to be an argument about the structure of the industry. Okay, how many firms, let's say, that's not structure, but that's usually the way it's talked about. How many firms are there in the business? But really, that's not what people are arguing about. People are arguing about the conduct of firms. Okay, this is a price that I don't like. This is a pricing structure that I don't like. I don't like early termination fees. I don't like subsidized handsets. I don't like congestion pricing. I don't like metered pricing. It's all about the conduct of firms. Okay? I don't like the type of investment you're making. The structure only gets implicated because in the standard old school way of thinking about economics of industries was the structure conduct performance paradigm, where the structure is basically causal to the conduct. I mean, that's old school, but that's the way it was looked at. Okay, so the structure only comes in because somebody says, I don't like the conduct. I don't like this set of prices that I see or this price structure that I see. And that's really the debate, okay? And Tom touched on that a little bit as well. So, and then the question in the structure conduct performance paradigm, you go from structure is causal to conduct and conduct is causal to performance, which is the efficiency, say, of the industry. Okay. The funny thing about the argument is that there will never be a structure that allows you to stop the conduct debate. There will always, everywhere, be somebody to complain. It doesn't matter what industry it is. People complain. There's no industry that gives me everything I want. None. Okay. So there's always going to be a complaint. And in the telecom business, if you go back to structure, it's always going to be concentrated enough to blame it on the structure. So you can fight all you want to about the structure of the industry, but in the end it's irrelevant to a large extent because somebody is going to complain about the conduct of the firms. It will never be have an HHI of 1800, okay, which might get you there. So you're going to have that fight. So the issue is, how do I deal with the conduct arguments? Okay. And how you deal with the conduct arguments, in my opinion, is this. The first question you have to ask is market structure important to the conduct that you observe? Okay, for example, the long debate over a la carte pricing for video. okay? And it was a big debate. And people were saying, oh, prices will go up, prices will go down, quality will go up, and that whole debate. And the one response was, oh, but there's competition in video. We don't need to worry about it. Well, it turns out that the extent of competition in the market is irrelevant to the bundling decision. The bundling decision is motivated by outside parties. Okay, not even a monopolist would force somebody to take something that they wanted and incur a cost to do so. That would be stupid. Okay, so it doesn't have anything to do with monopoly. It doesn't have anything to do with competition. Okay, it's an external force, the programmers who want their things put together with certain other things because that maximizes the value of the programming. Okay, so it's not the cable industry. The other thing, the other question is the conduct implying poor performance? And Tom brought this point up. Okay? And it's not obvious that what we're observing is true. Congestion pricing is something that improves the performance of the industry. Okay? It doesn't allow some people to impose cost on others. Okay? If we're going to say that the positive externalities of broadband should force the government to spend billions of dollars subsidizing it, we also have to recognize, because the firms don't account for the positive externality, we also need to recognize that it's fairly rare for firms to account for the negative externalities. Okay? And the fact that they do should not be punished for that. Metered pricing is a standard. I don't think the firms really want to do that, but it would certainly most likely encourage increased investments in the networks. Another interesting point is these are multi-product industries. Okay, and this is very important with respect to the conduct-performance relationship. If you take, for example, a two-goods firm, and you say, this firm makes zero profits, and we're going to set its prices to maximize consumer welfare. Okay, this is the what would Buddha do economic model of pricing. Okay, so who's going to complain, right? No profits for the firm, and consumer welfare is maximized. Let's fix one price at some relationship to marginal cost and then allow these products to have different relationships. There is no telling what the relationship of price to cost is going to be for the second good. Okay? It could be well below cost, marginal cost. It could be well above marginal cost. And what we observe on the conduct question, for example, with SMS for text messaging, is people say, oh, the price cost margin on text messaging is huge. Okay, therefore, it's not competitive. It's got nothing to do with anything. You can't pick one product out of the 15 that the wireless guys are selling you and say the price-cost margin is high on that one. It must be not competitive. Well, they're giving you a telephone, right, a $500 telephone, basically give you the thing or charge you $100 for it. So there's subsidies going on in there. There's some things priced above cost in multi-product settings and some things priced below cost. The restaurant business is probably the most competitive business, one of the most competitive businesses in the country, right? They give you bread and water, and they charge you three times for the bottle of wine. Is that business not competitive? Of course it's competitive. Okay, so you can't pick these little pieces of conduct out and say this is a problem. So when we think about what's going on in this conduct-centric argument, okay, the conduct-centric debate, is really market structure driving this, okay, and B, is it really a bad thing? Okay, it's not bad because I say it's bad, okay, because I don't like it, okay. Who doesn't like metered pricing? The guys that consume a lot, okay. The guys that don't would like it because their prices would go down, okay. So those are the kinds of questions that I think should be asked, and those are the kind of this is the way that I think about the problem now, is not sitting around arguing about how many firms there are, but asking the question, does it matter how many firms there are based on what you're complaining about or what people complain about, and is what you're complaining about actually leading to bad performance from an economic perspective? Of course, it is from an economic perspective, which generally means it's not terribly important to a lot of people. But don't spread that word, please. And that's all I got.
Well, thank you very much, George, and everyone else. Before we move to Q&A, I should ask any of the panelists if they'd like to respond directly to various points that they have not yet responded to, particularly Jeff or Larry.
I only have one thing. I agree with everything my friend Rob said, but one thing. And that is on this question of wireless substitution on the data front. I don't know how many of you have followed this kind of cord-cutting debate on the voice front, right? But if you go back 5 years, a lot of people were saying, a lot of people will say, even very recently, that wireless voice is not an economic substitute for wireline voice. And they make arguments similar to the ones, and Rob's a great economist, so he I think will agree with the framework I'm proposing here, but similar to what Rob suggested, which is, you know, it wouldn't be a substitute for me. I mean, I've got to have a wireline phone, or there are a lot of people who need to have a wireline phone, or I've got a home alarm system, so I've got to have a wireline phone, or I have a fax, so I've got to have a wireline phone. So there's some people for whom a cell phone will never be a substitute for a wireline phone, and that's undoubtedly true. But what we're thinking about here is the question of whether or not wireless telephony serves as a competitive check on wireline telephony. The question in that, in other words, is not whether it is a substitute for everyone, but rather whether it is a substitute for enough people that if, in this case, wireline telephony were to attempt to raise its prices above competitive levels, more people would switch to wireless than otherwise, the rate of switching would increase, and therefore deteriorate the excess profits that the wireline folks would have otherwise made from this price increase if there were no substitute. That's the competitive question. That's the answer. That's the question in competitive analysis. Now, I would agree with Rob. I don't think we're there today. If you were to do a merger guidelines, Department of Justice antitrust-based review of the market for wireline data, I don't think you would see 3G wireless in that market today. But with the advent, as Rob said, of 4G, which is upon us, Verizon starts deployment this year. 250 million households in the next couple of years from Clearwire, AT&T, and Verizon. Three pipes. Okay. I think as you look a year or two down the road, you will find that 4G wireless is an economic substitute for data. And as a result, we won't be talking about two pipes or duopoly. We will, if we're talking about anything, we should appropriately be talking about 4-5 or even the magical CFA, Consumer Federation of America, I guess, 6 competitors that people are looking for will be the reality of that marketplace. And again, it's just to be clear, it's think about yourself and think about the people you know. Would you give up your wireline data connection? I don't know, but a whole lot of people, somebody in the back is nodding their head, but a whole lot of people, I live off a laptop. Right? If my laptop was getting 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 megabits up and down, or down and one or two up, you know, I'm not typically watching movies on my laptop. I'm watching movies on my cable TV. I don't know that I'd pay the extra $50 a month for cable or Fios broadband if I'm doing it on my wireless laptop. And there are a lot of people like that. There are enough people like that that doesn't have to work for everybody. It just has to work for enough people that on the margins, when data providers, wireline data providers, try to raise their prices, there's an alternative that some people, enough people, will switch to.
I'm glad you now agree with me, Jeff. I actually
just expanding on your point.
I agree with everything you just said, actually. I think satellite has that same role at some level. It's not a full substitute or a competitive substitute, but it has some disciplining power. And as technology gets better, the disciplining power will get better. LTE will, I think, have that potential, certainly.
Tom?
Yeah, I want to say that I congratulate Robert on attempting to disagree with me. It was an unsuccessful attempt. And Robert had...
Well, he doesn't have the PowerPoints.
Well, he didn't read the PowerPoints carefully enough. It says very explicitly, ceteris paribus. Come on. But he, you know, brings up a very good point. More competition is not a free lunch. The reason you have the market developing the way it's developed is there are a lot of efficiencies to that. And, a lot of people have tried to enter and make it a triopoly. And some of us have lost money on those stocks, too. And whenever I hear one of these companies going under, if I don't own it, I think, God, I missed an opportunity for some more, for some more negative returns. Get the Hazlett bestseller, How to Avoid the Capital Gains Tax for the Rest of Your Life. Okay? Forthcoming. But, a lot of people have made this mistake, including in his... when he was alive, his old days, George Stigler, who started out with many economists in the 1940s and 50s having a radical deconcentration policy. Go back and read Henry Simons from the 1930s if you want to see something crazy about deconcentrating industry as though it were a free lunch. And, maybe it comes back a little bit, and if I gave the impression, being a recovering PPTer, that there was not a cost to deconcentration. Of course, that's wrong. And the markets evolve as they evolve in many respects because of these efficiency properties. And I thank George Ford for recalling OVS, which was the new and improved version of VDT, video dial tone, which was about a decade-long proceeding at the Federal Communications Commission, ended in the 96 Telecommunications Act. And after 10 years, I found that we actually had produced an enormous amount of regulatory effort to accommodate 1,250 subscribers in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And I counted it out. It actually was 1.53 subscribers per filing. This is the formal filing, not counting ex parties. But I thought that was, I was actually stunned that we actually had more subscribers than filings. I applaud the commission on that productivity metric.
It's part of the
I
price.
I apologize to the members of the communications bar for that.
I don't know how many people here deal much with state regulation, but what's funny about the difference in the argument here in Washington and at the state level is that there's a large number of states that have just completely deregulated telephone service. And you go to NARUG meetings now, and there's just no discussion of telephone whatsoever, because they don't regulate the telephone business. In the state of Alabama, just passed a law to deregulate the telephone business. And you ask the state commissioners, and you say, well, okay, we deregulate. Tell what happened. And you'd think there'd be some giant hearing with thousands of people with their arms raised and torches outside.
Like you took away people's analog television.
Yeah, exactly. And there's just not. In the telephone business, I mean, is at least, is much like the broadband business. I mean, if you think about the players, it's the cable industry and it's the telephone industry and it's the wireless guys are sort of all in the same thing. And maybe the wireless guys are a bit more in the telephone business than the broadband business at this point. I think that's going to change a little bit. But you're seeing at the people at the grassroots, okay, really involved at this, saying that, we deregulated and it's really no big deal. Prices didn't go up. So there's a, from a practical perspective, I think there's a difficulty with the state. But then again, it's not about, like I said, it's not about the structure of the industry. It's about, I don't like that price. Okay. And to some extent, you read the debate and you realize, and this is just something I thought of the other day, that the arguments today are that price is the enemy of the people. The price system is the enemy. The market system is the enemy. And that's the danger that we're facing. There is no solution other than the one that I mandate that's suitable to everybody. But who that person's going to be is the interesting question. Some people think wireless is a substitute, and Rob may not. So it depends on whether Rob's in charge or mine in charge. That's the problem, issue. What's that?
Could I be?
Sure.
Well,
better you than me.
If you're all done... or almost done. I'm going to pose one question to Larry first, and anyone else can answer it second, and then I'll open questions to the floor. So You indicated the need to compare imperfections in the marketplace to imperfections in the regulatory process. Now, we've heard of several of them, but would you like to elaborate on that?
Imperfections in each. Well, we know if you think either is perfect, you haven't been watching cable news recently. And then I sometimes sit there with a stopwatch and try to find out what the which commentary is more negative about how the government works or how markets work. It's kind of a coin toss. My major concern about how government works, and especially with respect to this issue and this sector, is I'm firmly convinced that regulators and politicians simply do not give enough credence to how capital markets work. The fact of the matter is that, I mean, I agree with other things that have been said. It's not all about structure. I think it may not, not necessarily about conduct. But at the end of the day, no national broadband policy makes any sense if it does not cultivate an enormous amount of capital formation out of the private sector. Somebody mentioned $2,000 to $3,000 per household. You can get in rural areas where loop links are long, you can get that up to $4,000 or $5,000. If you start trying to meet the requirements of effective competition and have six alternatives for each consumer, you're looking at $12,000 to $14,000. Anyway, suddenly the numbers really, really, really get big. I spent 4 years on Wall Street, and I learned as an academic economist, I learned a lot about how financial people and investors think that are different from how we economists think. They're very concerned with risk. They're very concerned with return. They're very concerned with growth. And they're very concerned with the ability to amortize these investments in a reasonable period of time. Some years ago, I wrote a paper, you know, that looked at, drew a matrix between what the government does, a variety of government activities, the FCC in particular, versus risk, return, growth, earnings, and opportunity, and tried to spell that out, that impact on the cost of capital. Well, to sum all that up, it seems to me that a lot of things that are being presented from other perspectives to the FCC, that we ought to regulate this, we ought to make sure it's open, we ought, blah, blah, you pick it, is basically going to dry up private capital. And by the way, Bernstein's not the only one that expresses this. You know, when you start thinking about putting in $4,000 or $5,000 or $3,000 or even $2,000 per household, you know, you make investors very, very, very nervous. So my main concern would be that the next administration, this administration, and this group of regulators, you know, be well informed by the impact of the rules they impose on the willingness of people to give up my 401k. And I would just ask any of you, you know, as a thought experiment, would you put your retirement fund in FIOS? Point one. And point two, in order to encourage you to put your retirement fund in FIOS, what would you like the FCC to do? Okay? Now, I'll send a questionnaire around a little bit later. But there are a lot of people like you and like us. Thank you.
Yeah, I think you need a paramedic for Link Hoeing right
now. Yeah. So there's a jump in. There's an easy answer to that question. Right? So the easy answer to that question is you would like the FCC to do what public knowledge and free press and others seem to want them to do, which is impose rate of return regulation, which is what we're talking about, on Verizon and the other broadband companies. Ultimately, what this boils down to, and this is from Mark Cooper's Consumer Federation of America filing at the FCC on Monday. Mark says the debate is not between capitalism and socialism, as it was recently portrayed in the election campaign, but between a pragmatic, progressive approach to capitalism that was implemented in the U.S. in the New Deal and the radical market fundamentalism approach of the last 30 years. So, and he's being truthful here, right? I mean, one lesson I think we all ought to learn is listen to what people say because they might mean it. And so there is this tremendous push to go back to what amounts to, when you regulate something as a regulated monopoly, there's kind of no place in between. regulating and the not regulating, ultimately you have to control prices, and ultimately you have to set prices on the basis of some standard, and ultimately the standard is a rate of return, the only standard that makes any economic sense at all, and the one that was adopted during the New Deal, is a rate of return-based standard. You try to set prices in order to get a rate of return such that the monopolist can continue operating and invest in new capital to the new infrastructure to the extent it makes sense. It's a time-honored model. We're still using it for electric companies and some other industries. That's what we're talking about here. And if that were to happen, you know, you're going to be able to clip your coupons on the Verizon Fios system just the way you could clip your coupons on AT&T for about 50 or 60 years between 1930 and 1980. It'll be a nice stable rate of return. If you look at how well that worked at the FCC, go back and read Ronald Coase's 1959 article about the Federal Communications Commission and ask yourself the question, you know, is regulatory failure something that we ought to start being concerned about? You can look at 1996 and everything that happened after that. That was ugly. Go back and look at 1956 and AT&T rate hearings. It was no benefit for consumers coming out of that process.
I'd just quickly add, I think it's not just that people are hearkening back to the New Deal. I think there are people in this debate who are hearkening back to the 1890s populist movement.
Right.
And there's a cartoon I had in a book I wrote on, had a chapter on the history of opposition to new technology. And there's a wonderful cartoon from the populist movement, and it has a little tagline, something like "Our Platform," and then has a picture of a railroad station with a telegraph line, and it has U.S. Railroad and Telegraph System. And that was the platform,
right,
which was government ownership of these essential networks. And I think partly there are people in this debate who really would just move beyond rate of return regulation and go to municipal or co-op-owned networks as really these are publicly inherited. These are public interest goods. They ought to be owned by the public.
And inevitably that means monopoly.
Well, but it would be a government monopoly.
Yeah, but yeah. Right. You have to get rid of people to make that happen. I think that's... How do you make that happen? This could be interesting. How do you get people to leave the business?
I'm going to let Larry have the last word on this, and then we will go to audience questions.
I don't know if I agree with Jeff or not, but as one of the last sort of, I'm guessing, looking around the age here, I mean, I was an actual practitioner of rate of return regulation at the FCC, and while I was there, we had two rate cases, AT&T. One of the rate cases required a rate reduction. And the other one was when they were under the allowed rate of return, it was a petition for a rate increase. So I think the real question about what kind of regulation we're talking about here is if we were to impose rate of return regulation right now, we would have to raise rates substantially in this sector in order to get it up there. And if I look at what Rob's writing about the demand elasticity for broadband, if we bring all these companies and look at my table, if you get the rate of return up to what's a weighted average cost of capital, which probably is in double digits now, we get all these returns up to double digits, we're probably looking at $140, $150 per household of broadband. Now, even our elasticity studies don't go through all that. So, again, I think we're talking less about rate of return regulation than we are sort of hands-on regulation of sort of traffic management. For heaven's sakes, we don't want, you know, we talk about price discrimination. We don't want to hinder the carrier's ability to differentiate their prices and differentiate their products the way it's done economy-wide. So, anyway, thanks for the equal time.
I think this is a good break to change the tape on the video while we move to audience questions. We have a microphone holder, Adam Marcus, who will come around and set you up to be recorded. I ask that if you have a question, you state your name and affiliation and then ask your question. And it'll just be a minute or two before we change the tape. In the meantime, if we have time at the end, I'll ask our panelists to have a final 30-second opportunity to tell the new FCC what to do or not to do.
Uh, I'd take that, 30 seconds.
Okay.
Some time ago, there was a hearing on the Hill about net neutrality, and one of the senators said, who among you would stand up and defend price discrimination in this sector? Okay. My advice to the next chairman is I, for one, stand up and wholeheartedly support price discrimination in this sector. It's everywhere. And the downside of not permitting price differentiation is an enormous reduction in economic welfare. So that would be my advice.
Okay. We'll let the other four speak at the very end after we had a few audience questions. I hope somebody has them after I've done that. Anyone? Anyone? No?
I'm Jack O'Connor with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Lowly intern. I just wanted to ask Mr. Atkinson, he mentioned that facilitating for competition and growth in broadband is the way to go, and I just wanted to ask if he could suggest two or three of what he thinks are the most important ways the federal government should do that.
Okay, thank you. Well, I think in a couple of different, in three different areas. One is remove barriers to production. So, for example, I just testified on Monday on a bill to ban discriminatory wireless taxes. I think things like that, right-of-way fees, excessive right-of-way fees that localities charge to make money off of national broadband deployment. I think reform would fall into that same category on the production side. On the I frankly think we need to copy the Japanese and the Koreans. I would move to some sort of more generous expensing of these very high-cost, risky, long-term capital investments that in some cases may not be that long-term with the way depreciation, where innovation is going. So have some sort of expensing provisions that's more generous than where we are today. And then I would put a lot more focus if I were the FCC, although really this isn't their bailiwick, but I think that's what's got to be a core part of the plan, is on the demand side. I think that's where we're falling down as a nation. And so I think I would do some sort of USF for broadband, something along lines of reverse auctions, one-time reverse auctions for capital costs to get it to rural areas, assuming that the Recovery Act doesn't solve the problem, which it won't. It's a nice start, but it won't solve the problem. But then much more on the digital demand side, so computer training. I support even subsidies for ownership, computer ownership, something like Lifeline Link Up, those sorts of programs. But a lot of it on the training side and the facilitation side.
Anyone else?
Mark Adams, PFF. This is to Dr. Atkinson. When you talk about the societal waste that would be involved in having many lines going into the same property, I was thinking about often when new technologies are rolled out, so we have VHS and Betamax, more recently DVD, HD, and Blu-ray, we often don't know in advance which technology is going to be the most efficient, and perhaps in the case of broadband, do you think that it's possible that we might have competing technologies, or is that something we can rule out?
Well, I know you're absolutely right that we don't know those things, although in most cases those things get sorted out fairly quickly, and there aren't in standards, there aren't two standards. Sometimes there are. But in all those examples you alluded to, there wasn't a government policy to add a third standard. You know, hey, we don't like really Blu-ray or HD. We're going to come up with, LD or something. So, I think for the foreseeable future, unless for some bizarre reason somebody gains some sort of weird advantage that I don't see, we'll just have two pipes going into homes, and then we'll have a third wireless, and they each have pros and cons and advantages. And so I think the idea is somehow that there are people who say that it has to be fiber, and that's the – I like fiber a lot, but I think that there are other technologies that can perform as well. I think we should be agnostic on the technology and not agnostic on the performance. We want better performing high-speed networks. My only concern would be that government A picks that, or B says that we have to get an additional ones more than what the market itself is going to provide.
Anyone else? Ken?
I hope that's not a consensus on your last view, right?
That was very dramatic. But
I would like to make a comment a little bit related to that. you know, there's a lot of argument about being behind and broadband, and I agree with Rob completely. We really in this country have a demand side problem more than a supply side problem. But I mean, here's the problem with that is, as you spend, I mean, the purpose of broadband is not to run up subscription counts. I mean, that's not what it's about. Okay, it's broadband is important because it generates some value, okay, some benefit to people, okay? If you're spending thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to convince somebody to buy the service, the marginal contribution of that to the society's welfare is trivial, if not negative. Okay, so you really, I mean, the externality effect cannot be that big to justify some of the things that people have proposed. So when we think about, I mean, we're down to the point where the government is having to throw billions of dollars at this problem to try to get more subscriptions. Okay? I think we're sort of at the end of the highest valued contribution of broadband from a subscription perspective, and now we're in the world where it's really, really expensive to get people to join the network. And if it's really expensive to get people to join the network, then the marginal contribution of those subscribers is low. So, you know, are we behind? Well, we're not so far behind that it doesn't cost us $7 billion to make things better, which is saying a lot, I think.
Let me, at the risk of adding facts and data, which I'm trying to do a little bit of, one of the things submitted on Monday was a study by Nielsen looking at who does and doesn't have broadband, and it's really interesting data, or internet access. Of all of the people, households in the U.S. that do not have internet access today, about 25% of those households have children. The other 75% are adults. And it seems to me ought to have the option to choose not to have internet access, and they have so chosen. There is a presumption that, again, kind of big misunderstandings, that 100% is the right number. 100% may be the right number for health care, for health insurance. There is no reason to believe, or it may not be, you can have your own opinion on that, but whatever might lead a lot of people to think that 100% is the right number on health insurance, which is their externalities, when you break your leg and you don't have health insurance, we all pay for it. Right? That does not exist in the broadband world. If you choose not to have broadband, you're not hurting me. You're an adult. So for the 75% of households in the United States who have chosen not to have broadband today, I think we ought to let them rest. Okay? We ought to make it available, and I think there are arguments from a rural development perspective for making broadband ubiquitously available. That's what I think the $7.2 billion is about, and we might spend some of that wisely. But the notion that we ought to, you know, assume, as George said, that 100% is the right number in terms of subscriptions, I think it's just wrong and misguided.
Well, yeah, there was actually a recent survey done in a state I won't mention about broadband subscription. These mapping programs, by the way, always do usually do extensive surveys, which are very informative, where one of the top reasons the people who didn't have broadband, didn't buy broadband, that had it available, was they did not want to bring pornography into their house. Now, that's an interesting point. Are we going to force people who view the internet as being a negative contribution to their homes? Are we going to force them to buy it? Or are we going to prohibit a company that says, I will block all pornography from coming into your house at my end of the deal so you don't have to worry about it at your end of the deal, which is in fact quite complicated? Are we going to stop them from doing that under the umbrella of network neutrality? Those are the interesting little problems that are going to have to be dealt with as we push to the final frontier of broadband adoption here.
I just want to respond to that because Jeff, I think you're setting up a false dichotomy. I mean, I would not mandate that 100%. I'd mandate 99.8%. No, I'm joking. Look,
I knew you were a market-oriented country.
Exactly. Exactly. Market-oriented Democrat. The right number is more than what we have, and it's less than 100 and more than 70. And I absolutely, there are people who simply don't want it for whatever reason, George's point or But there are lots of people that are on the margin who don't know about it, they don't understand it, they don't have digital skills. Those are people that we can help at a reasonably low price. Secondly, there are lots of homes that are slightly above the cost point, above the cost curve, that we can help supply to at a reasonably low price. So, you know, there are people out there, say 100% of people should have fiber to the home. Even the Alaska igloo guy read a nice story, but he's 200 miles from the nearest of anywhere. I think he'd be, what, $400 million to get him? So I don't think it's quite the same way. And the other piece of this, too, there's a very nice study by Lauren Hitt, who's a professor at Penn. And he shows very convincing. He actually argues that he sort of tries to rebut the studies on externalities on IT investment and business by saying the externality is only one-to-one, it's not higher. So in other words, his argument, and I think it's pretty good data, is that there's a strong externality from corporate investment in IT, that corporations benefit, but there's a one for every dollar they invest, the economy as a whole benefits by an extra dollar. That's a pretty large externality. And I wouldn't be surprised if broadband doesn't have similar externalities. So the smart, to me, policy is to figure out where are those investments that make good sense, and you don't want to go too far with them. But at the same time, I don't really think the sort of the abdication policy of just leaving it completely up to the market is where we should be either.
Tom? Yeah, one thing that just came up in passing is actually quite an interesting market to look at and part of the broadband issue, and that is the television market, which, of course, is a multi-channel cable distribution at this point in time, although I hear there's something happening with the 1952 technology today. The experiment in the United States over the last couple of decades has actually been quite profound. That is to say, at this point in time, there is quite a bit of competition in the United States video distribution market through two nationwide satellite programmers, cable television networks, and now the entry of head-to-head competition. So this is with the telephone operators. This is an area of expanding market structure in terms of the numerical judgment on competition. And in fact, this is the golden era for video programming. I mean, there's just an absolute explosion. And in fact, if you look at the video industry, there's a huge shift in the terms of trade. Now more than half of all industry revenues are going to the programmers, not to the operators. It was 90-10 in favor of the operators 20 years ago. There's a profound shift. We're getting a flood of new programming. Somebody mentioned that, you know, internationally the U.S. has higher prices for television. Have you been in a German hotel and turned on the television? Have you ever gotten stuck in the U.K. with one of those three-day cricket matches dominating the waves? They don't have Bridezilla, okay? I'll just leave it there. But the United States, you know, has 500. We actually have 500 channels, and if you have, you know, one of the actual participants in the digital TV transition supplying your house, you have hundreds of choices. Now, that, of course, that comes to the broadband question a very direct way. That package is there. There are choices. And when people walk up into the broadband world and say, well, it's obvious, we need 100 megabits per second to the home, every home in America, that's what we need. And if there's any conversation to be had at that point, you say, well, for what? And the answer, well, video, okay? And if they're pressed, when you point out that the video is already there in the form that it is, and the DVR is actually a nice little device to help make that a much smarter pipe. Of course, the fallback position from there is, well, we need gaming. Okay, now, we all want these platforms. They're going to do a lot, and there's a lot of option value in these things. But, again, it's not free. In fact, it's really expensive to just start buying these options without knowing what's going to ride on there. And, indeed, it's fairly clear. If gaming is your game, then wireless becomes a hell of a substitute. A hell of a substitute. And, in fact, other devices that are, you know, not computers become substitutes in very nice ways. And fixed systems may not be, may, you know, it may be the iPhone that's the gaming innovation. And that is the platform that, that is going to carry us, you know, competing with the G phone and RIM BlackBerry and so forth with multi, you know, the smartphone space. So, you know, which takes me to my favorite topic, and that is spectrum. And so what the FCC needs to do is to put some overlay rights over that very precious TV band spectrum and do something useful with that. And to get the LTE systems and the next generation of wireless technology in a very robust way into the consumer's hands and not waste those precious resources, which currently are on a trajectory to be used just as effectively next year as they have been for the last 60 years by the spectrum allocation system.
Well, thank you, Tom. George, do you want to put in your final words?
I've probably said enough today.
Okay. Jeff?
Yeah, I just want to – so this I started out saying that the groups that are filing at the FCC, making these big filings at the FCC, basically want to go back and reexamine 10 years. So 10 years ago this year, the chairman of the FCC, Bill Kennard, really began the set of policies that we have implemented for the past 10 years. It was in the context of, as I recall, it was TCI and AT&T were merging. AT&T was in the process of making its first of dozens of catastrophic investments. That one, I think, was the TCI-AT&T merger. And Bill Kennard was asked to pass on that. And a lot of the same groups that filed on Monday were at the FCC 10 years ago saying that you need to impose an open access condition on cable. You need to let multiple ISPs operate over the cable pipe rather than let cable just have its own ISPs. So basically imposing unbundling, imposing the set of policies that are the opposite of the policies that we ultimately ended up imposing and the opposite of the policy and arguing for the policies that these groups still want to impose today. Let me read to you, you know, what I think are some of the most important words have been uttered in telecom policy in a decade. In a speech given by Chairman Kennard 10 years ago. He said then, it is easy to say that government should write a regulation, to say that as a broad statement of principle, that a cable operator shall not discriminate against unaffiliated internet service providers on a cable platform. It's quite another thing to write that rule, to make it real and then enforce it. So if we do have the hope of facilitating a market-based solution here, we should do it because the alternative is to go to the telephone world, a world that we are trying to deregulate, and just pick up this whole morass of regulation and dump it wholesale on the cable pipe. When I look at the cost of regulation versus the benefits, when I look at the prospect that we can have a robust, competitive broadband marketplace, I conclude that we have to resist the urge to regulate and let it play out for just a while longer, as Bill Kennard, 1999, and that is what I hope every member of the FCC would read.
Thanks, Rob. Do you want to take the final bite?
I think at the end of the day, this debate, you know, people choose the camp they're in, and then they choose the data and argumentation to support that. And I think the most important thing the FCC can do is to figure out what camp it's in, and are they in the abdicate, facilitate, or regulate camp. They ought to be in the facilitate camp, in my view. Once you're in that camp, then what follows is pretty straightforward, I think.
Well, I want to thank my panelists and the audience. I think it's been a really great session, and I now know that my title, the answer is, it simply doesn't matter, and I should never have posed the question. Thank you all for coming.